From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. While the push of secularization continues in places like Canada and Europe, Americans are remaking religion to suit their needs. Think communion on Sunday, Buddhist meditation on Saturday night, and a dash of Hindu philosophy and Native American ceremony whenever for inspiration. Meet Religion 2.0.
Religion is being held accountable to life. That's really what people are doing today. And they're really holding religion accountable to their lives. If it works, they use it. If it doesn't, they don't.
I don't really like to say take you to a sacred space. It's more a sense of realizing that you already are in a sacred place, no matter where it is. If it's an outhouse behind the Denny's, you know, it's still a sacred space.
To look, for example, at these great big mega churches, the startling thing to me is that when you go into them and sit through them, you have the feeling that Jesus walked in here yesterday, said a few things. And I think it's lost its, that what I like to call its indefinability there.
Clark Strand is tracking a new group of people called the nuns, those who don't affiliate with any particular religious group, but still consider themselves spiritual people. Strand is the author of the book How to Believe in God. He says America is unique among developed nations for its continued religiosity, even in the face of a new competitive religious marketplace where people want to know, what can religion do for me, instead of what can I do to serve my religion?
The nuns are these people who, when they are asked a question, what religious affiliation do they belong to, answer none of the above, so hence the nuns. And these are people who, I think up until probably around 30 or 40 years ago, were loosely affiliated, sometimes closely affiliated with one of the major, usually Christian denominations in America, but now they've drifted away.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because it may be in some ways just a redefinition. These are people who felt comfortable claiming affiliation 30 years ago and haven't changed their views, but now feel comfortable not claiming an affiliation.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. And I think by far the most interesting statistic that's come out over the past 18 months or so is the fact that these people, who basically comprise about 16.1% of the general population, we're thinking about somewhere around 50 million people, these people overwhelmingly say that they believe in God. In other words, the number of atheists and agnostics out there hasn't really dramatically increased. What's increased is the number of people who are willing to claim no affiliation whatsoever, even though they claim to have religious beliefs.
Because it's changed the religious marketplace, hasn't it? The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life had a study recently you quoted as calling this a competitive religious marketplace. That's a change.
Well, it is, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, because if you look at global trends right now, in developed nations around the world, religion is in decline and secularism is on the upsurge. So in America, this is not as true, and I think it's because there is such a plurality of religious traditions here to choose from. It makes for a more competitive environment, and so the religiosity of Americans is much higher. In fact, we're really the only developed nation in the world that has what you would consider a high level of religiosity today.
Does this mean that religion has become a kind of consumer product? People know what they want. They go out and compare this with that and buy the one that suits them best?
Well, there are different ways of looking at that. I mean, yes, you could say that. And I think that there was this term that people used to use. It's not quite so much in vogue today. Cafeteria Catholic, they called it. Person who picks and chooses what they want to believe and what practices they want to subscribe to and leave the rest behind at their own convenience. But I think what we're seeing in America today, specifically in America, but elsewhere in the world as well, is something more profound. It's a more profound paradigmatic shift at work, I believe, whereby religion is being held accountable to life. It used to be that people followed, and this was true for really at least the past 2,000 years or so, it used to be that people followed a paradigm of life-serving religion. and they were told what to believe. I use sometimes the metaphor of the whole CD approach to religion, where you're expected to buy the whole package and listen to only the songs on that CD, as opposed to what I call the iReligion approach, where you basically just download what you want and what you need and leave the rest behind. That's really what people are doing today. And they're really holding religion accountable to their lives. If it works, they use it. If it doesn't, they don't.
This sounds personal to you, as though you have, in fact, yourself done some looking and mixing of traditions. Is that true?
Yes, it's quite true. In fact, my book, How to Believe in God, Whether You Believe in Religion or Not, is really a kind of a record of that search, which began when I was born as a Christian in the South and then reaches its climax, so to speak, during my years as a Zen Buddhist monk. And then its resolution, ultimately, in coming back to the Bible after years and years of practicing Zen meditation and teaching it, to discover that in the Bible, the same teachings were there, only they needed to be thrown into relief, as it were, by taking a bearing off of another religious tradition. But in my journeys, I practiced every major world religion and many of the prayer and meditation practices associated with them. It was a kind of a way of exploring my identity as a 21st century person. Even in 1990, when I left the monkhood, I had the sense that we were on the verge of a great spiritual revolution, not just in this country, but in the world, that as we bumped up against global systems, global realities like global warming, the global economy, models like this, that we would begin to find ourselves in need of a bigger understanding of religion and of God.
What about the long-standing religions? What happens to the accumulated wisdom of centuries of study, thousands of years that have gone into refining the views of Judaism, of Islam, of Catholicism, or Lutheranism? Is there a danger of losing things when you pick a little from here and a little from there and a little from somewhere else?
Well, I think whatever is wise will make the cut. And I think that's what wisdom is. I think that people will naturally gravitate towards those elements of religion that are truly useful for them and that truly have relevance to life. And I believe that they will let go of those things that aren't really tenable going forward.
What do you say to the traditionalists who speak of their belief system being watered down from the cherry picking that you're talking about?
Well, that's a very good question. What would I say to their claims that their religion is being watered down? I guess my answer would be, if their religion can be watered down, then it probably already is watered down. In other words, it's already weak. It's already lost its potency. Right. The very people who cry out the most about things like this, I think, are the people who are holding on to the religious beliefs that really have lost their relevancy, the ones that are really indefensible. For instance, priestly authority. People who are very, very invested in priestly authority going forward over the next 100 years are going to be holding low cards. They're not really holding on to a religious idea that's going to have much relevancy going forward. We're living in an internet age, an age of blogs, an age of discussion groups where there's a much more egalitarian grassroots approach to everything, but especially to spirituality. And so the sort of top-down authoritarian model of, for instance, giving a sermon to a group of passive listeners who are just supposed to glean wisdom from it, I don't think that there's a great deal of future for that. So, for instance, that's just one example of something that, you know, yes, you could say that, you know, Catholicism could get watered down, but I would argue that actually it might get watered up. It might actually produce some good, strong grassroots spirituality out there if they would give up on that model and try a more populist model instead.
But on the other hand, we do have this human tradition in the systems of religious belief that tends to focus down our set of beliefs rather than opening them out. What you're talking about is a very free-form consumer model. Is this going to be simply a new variant on traditional religions?
I don't think so. I think that the wave of secularism that is really sweeping across the world, and just because America, you know, has a higher degree of religiosity at present doesn't mean that it won't eventually reach here. I think it will. And when that happens, the demands on religion are going to be such that it really becomes radically answerable for itself in a way that it never has been at any point in history. People are going to look at it with a much colder, cooler eye and ask, what in this is really serving life? What in this is really contributing to peace and happiness and goodwill throughout the world? And the answer, I think, will be that there are parts of religion that deeply contribute to the quality of life and to the health of a society. And so I don't think that by any means this will mean that people just dismiss religion. I just think that it means that religion will be held accountable.
Clark Strand is a contributing editor at Tricycle, a Buddhist review, and author of the book How to Believe in God.
Gentlemen, who is there among us who knows the way to destroy Gigantus?
There is no way. None that I happen to know of. Not one.
Brad Warner is a Japanese monster movie marketer. He's also a blogger, the bassist in the punk band Zero Defects in Los Angeles, and a Zen master. His brand of on-the-ground Buddhism mixes traditional teachings with the gritty realities of everyday life. In his new memoir, Zen Wrapped in Karma Dipped in Chocolate, Warner talks about the year he spent lecturing and leading retreats while his mother and grandmother died, his marriage fell apart, and he lost his dream job. He told Steve Paulson how he wound up as a Buddhist.
Well, I was a bass player for a hardcore punk band called Zero Defects in Akron, Ohio. And the reason I'd gotten into punk rock was because I felt kind of at odds with the rest of my high school society. And I thought we were kind of going the wrong direction. And punk rock seemed to be about something. You know, I wanted to play rock music, but I thought the rock music was kind of going the wrong way. And punk rock was about questioning society and questioning the standard values that are part of our culture. But I found ultimately that they didn't really take their own questioning far enough. They sort of stopped at themselves. So they would question everything but never look into what their own motivations were. And about the same time, I was a student at Kent State University just looking for some kind of a class to take on Eastern religions because I had an interest there. And the only class they had on offer was a class called Zen Buddhism. It was a non-credit course. And I just took that and was really, really impressed because here was a philosophy that even questioned itself. They had the sutra that the teacher read the first day was called the Heart Sutra, which goes and categorically denies all of Buddhist philosophy, which I thought was amazing. I thought, here's a philosophy that goes and denies itself. I want to know more.
Now, I have to say, you have a really interesting biography. the bit that I've read about it. I mean, not only is there this background in a punk band, there was your study of Zen, I mean, to the point where you became a teacher, a well-known teacher of Zen. And then you went off to Japan for years and worked with a company that made monster movies.
That's right, yeah.
Is there any connection between those three things?
I don't know. It's hard to say. There is a connection. I guess the connection is me. And I kind of got into all of those things for a lot of similar reasons because, well, going to Japan was ultimately an economic decision. I didn't have a decent job and I found a job over there. But the interest in the monster movies kind of came part and parcel somehow with that because I was into Japanese monster movies and Japanese culture, and Zen is part of that. And I know the first time that I encountered anything related to Zen was when I was a little kid and I was watching a TV show called Ultraman, which is a Japanese monster and superhero show. It's not even animated. It's all done with live action and guys in big rubber suits. And they have a scene where they're chanting the Heart Sutra, the sutra I just mentioned, they're chanting it because they've killed this monster, and they kind of feel a little bad about having killed this monster. It's a very strange episode. But so they were sort of interconnected, and I continued my study of Zen while I was working for the company that made the monster movies. And I remember at one point I asked my teacher, my Zen teacher, you know, do you think I should continue this job? Because it doesn't seem very Zen-like. And he was very encouraging about keeping the job because he thought it was exactly the right place that I should be.
So here you are. You've been practicing Zen Buddhism for years, for decades. You've been teaching it. A lot of people come to you looking for guidance. But you also write about just some tough stuff in your own life. This 1 year that you've written about where you had two deaths in the family, your mother and your grandmother, your marriage fell apart. Did your Buddhist practice help you get through these things?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the only thing that helped me get through it. You know, I don't know how I could have managed without it because I always had this stable ground to return to. And there are things in that book that I didn't even realize that people are kind of pointing out to me later, which is if you read it, and I didn't even read it this way, it's always that something will come along and will kind of rattle me, or rattles one who does this practice. It doesn't have to be me. And then you have this practice to return to. And by returning to it, you return to stability. And so anytime something happens, you kind of go back there. And I found that extremely useful. You know, somebody said, I don't know if this is true, he said, I would have killed myself if I'd had a year like that, you know, and just the fact that I didn't. But I didn't feel that way during that year, and probably because there was always this place to return to, this ground.
Hmm. Let me ask you about how you came to think about death. I mean, these deaths in your own family. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are obviously some big philosophical questions about, sure. I mean, do you think there is life after death? But I don't know, do you think your response to death was different than most other people who might go through these kinds of things?
Well, probably, because just philosophically, as far as what the Zen philosophy looks upon death as, is that we're born and we die constantly, that the me who existed a minute ago is dead and gone, and here I am, and I'm something else, possibly, which has a relation to what I was a minute ago, but isn't the same thing. So the idea of ultimate death is also, you know, you're dead at the end of your 76 years or whatever you get, is also just, it's something that occurs, but it's not something new. So, you know, when you lose somebody close to you, I have the feeling that there isn't really anywhere to go. So it's not as if my mother or my grandmother are exactly gone, even though I'll never see them or talk to them again. There's something more fundamental, and it's more than just their memories. It's sort of a presence that remains. It's as if the universe has a net consistency, you know, like it's full of all this stuff, which manifests itself as me and you and my grandmother and whoever else. And that doesn't really change. The essence of it doesn't change, but it undergoes a kind of transformation. Although I don't want to go any further than that and start speculating about reincarnation or rebirth or life after death.
Well, I know there are some people who talk about the sort of how Buddhism has been changed in some way as it's been adopted in the more secular West. And you would seem to be an example of that. I mean, someone who's sort of tossed out the supernatural elements of it, the overtly religious elements, and taken a far more secular version of Buddhism.
I suppose so. And it is a bit more secular, and I don't go for much of the ritual, but I do a bit of the ritual. I have some robes and I have some incense burners and I know a few chants and I can pull those out when I need to. So I don't want to throw it all away just yet. I've seen some teachers that are out there who are teaching what is basically Buddhism, but they're not telling you it's Buddhism. I don't want to name names, but there's several who are very, very popular these days out there. And it's not that I have any argument with what they teach, but I feel if I were to teach that way, it would be slightly dishonest because I did come to this through Buddhist practice and through a Buddhist teacher. So it wasn't just something that randomly or spontaneously burst into my brain, and now I'm here to tell the world about that. So I think that's not entirely honest. Yet I'm not really into the ritual aspects of it. I think they have their place, And they can be important, and it's nice to be able to do some of the ritual practices that are associated with Buddhism. I think there's a certain fundamental need we all have to participate in ritual, and it may be something that goes even deeper than religion itself. But in Zen practice, when you do these rituals, you're not really believing them. That's kind of the funny thing, is we will bow to a statue and offer it incense and chant at it, but we don't really believe that statue can hear our chants. We're doing the practice just to do it.
Isn't often the idea behind ritual, I mean, whether whatever religion we're talking about, is that it can help take you to a different place, sort of, you know, get you out of the mundane world and maybe into more of a sacred space. And couldn't you argue in some ways that Zazen, I mean, the practice of sitting meditation, is a ritual in itself?
Well, yeah, in that sense, it is a ritual, and it does kind of show you something different from your normal standing up and laying down kind of life. And the rituals do establish a certain mindset. You know, I don't like to use words like take you to a sacred place, but you could use that. But I think every place is a sacred space. That's why I don't really like to say take you to a sacred space. It's more a sense of realizing that you already are in a sacred place, even no matter where it is. If it's an outhouse behind the Denny's, you know, it's still a sacred space.
What makes that a sacred space? I mean, what makes anything a sacred space?
Well, because you're here, because it's real, because it's actually three-dimensional, touching, feeling presence is real, and that's important. So anywhere you find yourself is somewhere very, very important and very, very special and unique, and you shouldn't look away from it or look askance at it and go, oh, God, I wish I wasn't here. Well, you might think, oh, God, I wish I wasn't here, but it's also important to still be there, even if I wish I wasn't here is also part of what's going on at the moment. So every place has this kind of sacredness because it's there. It's real.
Brad Warner is the author of Zen Wrapped in Karma, Dipped in Chocolate. He's also a Zen teacher, a Japanese monster movie marketer, and a punk musician in the band Zero Defects.
Drop the A-bomb on me!
Coming up, the argument for religion without belief. Are you one of the new do-it-yourself spiritual? Get in touch with us through our website. It's ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It may seem counterintuitive to consider religion without belief, but that's exactly what James Carse does in his new book, The Religious Case Against Belief. Carse is a religious scholar who taught at New York University for years. In his book, Carse argues for the decoupling of religion and belief and re-examines the definition of religion. He told Steve Paulson that religion doesn't necessarily involve belief.
You know, it's an odd thing. Scholars of religion, historians of religion, are perfectly aware and have been for a long time that belief and religion really don't perfectly overlap. It's not that they're completely indifferent to each other, but you can easily be religious without being a believer, and you can be a believer in a way that's not in the least religious. Maybe one way to look at it is to consider, let's say you want to know what it means to be Jewish. So you draw up a list of beliefs that you or someone has thought Jews happen to hold. And so you go down that list and you go one after the other and you say, well, you know, I think I believe all of these. But does that make you a Jew? And obviously not. Being Jewish is far more than and far richer than acceding or agreeing to a certain list of beliefs. Now, it is the case that Christians, especially Christians, are interested in belief structures, in proper belief, in what they like to call orthodoxy, which simply means, from the Greek words, right teaching. So you want to be taught properly exactly what you are to believe as a Christian. However, looking over the history of Christianity, there's a very uneven track of orthodoxy. It's not at all clear exactly what one should believe. And in fact, the Christians have quarreled with each other endlessly over what that proper list might be.
So let me just back up for a moment then and sort of get at this larger question of belief. If you're saying that belief is not intrinsic to religion, what about faith? What is that?
Well, you know, the distinction is very often made between faith and belief, as if faith is one thing and belief is something quite different. You know, that's a possibility, but the problem with that distinction is that it has no background in the biblical setting. The Greek word for belief is translated both belief and faith. So in the New Testament, to believe and to have faith are really identical. And the emphasis seems, especially in early Christianity, to be on the phenomenon of belief itself. And what we now call faith in a larger, more general, wider sense was not really in their minds at the beginning. Getting those teachings right was what they were concerned with. Now, let me add, if I may, that to point up the difficulty of doing this, after the Nicene Creed, matters were definitely not solved. They were so unsolved, as a matter of fact, that to give you an idea of the very large, chaotic scene of Christian belief, a professor, Yaroslav Pelikan at Yale, very distinguished guy, recently drew up, published a 5-volume collection of the major Christian creeds. And altogether, there are 211 of them. And every one of them in some kind of disagreement with another. So first, I think it's very important, at least in Christianity, to understand that belief is a very large, chaotic phenomenon. And if we want to use the word faith, then we have to begin to look at maybe how one is religious as a believer rather than exactly what one believes.
It sounds like you're saying that if we just focus on belief itself, that word doesn't necessarily need to have any religious associations. I mean, you could just Nazism,
right,
or Maoism or Serbian nationalism.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, very passionate believers are very often not at all religious. However, it does happen to be the case, historically, it's quite obvious, that people who hold on to beliefs with great passion begin to understand themselves or interpret themselves, describe themselves as religious. For example, the Nazis, if you can imagine, really had a kind of pseudo-religious understanding of themselves. Hitler talked about a 10,000-year Reich. Well, that's taken right out of Christian mythology, really. You have a kingdom of God going on forever and ever. And even the swastika is, after all, in the form of a cross. So Hitler had, we don't need to exaggerate, he was a passionate believer, but not religious, but pseudo-religious. Taking on, you know, sort of ascribing to himself some sort of religious aura.
Okay. So what do you mean by religion then?
Well, religion is notoriously difficult to define. Enlightenment philosophers in the 18th century began to show more and more interest in other than Christian traditions. And then they naturally wanted to find if there's some sort of a unity, some sort of a category that could be called religious. So definitions of religion came right and left. Modern scholars have decided, I think they're almost unanimous on this, that there is no generalization that applies to all of the great living religions. Jews don't have a priesthood, Catholics and Christians do. The prayer in one tradition is different from another. The literature, the texts are radically different from each other. The attitude toward those texts are very different. So, you know, it leaves us with the question, is there any generalization one could make about religion? After all, we use the word.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that in fact, you do say this in your book, that the only defining characteristic of religion is its longevity.
It has to be around
for a long time to qualify as a religion.
Exactly, right. That's a very interesting contrast with belief systems. Belief systems have almost no longevity. I mean, think of Marxism as a serious political policy. It didn't last a century. In fact, only about 70 or 80 years. Nazism only went 12 years. And they were intense, complete, comprehensive, passionately held beliefs. But they ran out very quickly. And the reason the great religions don't run out as quickly is that they're able to maintain within themselves a deeper sense of the mystery, of the unknown, of the unknowable, the unsayable, that keeps the religion alive, that guarantees its vitality.
But if the only test of a religion is its staying power, are you saying Mormonism
right.
is not a religion? Or Pentecostalism, which some scholars say
right.
is the most important religious movement of the last century?
Yeah, those are large questions. I mean, will Mormonism hold out over the centuries? I mean, it's a difficult judgment. How long does longevity have to be? I don't have an answer for that. What I'd really like to focus on is how very long, extremely long, the great traditions are. There are traditions that aren't that long, Sikhism, various kinds of Middle Eastern religions, mystical movements, and so on, that may or may not make it over the millennia. Mormonism is an open question. You know, you can even come down and talk about Scientology. Does it really have staying power over the centuries? And, of course, I would doubt it. But we don't know yet.
Well, you actually say something startling at the end of your book. You say that we may be beginning to see the death throes of Christianity, which will surprise a lot of people considering how many people identify themselves as Christians around
yes, the world. Yes, right. I do, definitely. I think there's a fragmentation that's going on that's quite significant. And the tendency of very large bodies of Christians to identify with something outside their religious tradition, that is to say, with their country, with their ethnos, with their location on earth, with their culture. Once they've done that, once they've married their Christian faith with, let's say, a national or ethnic identity, then it loses its Christian character. And its deep historical Christian character. You know, maybe this is unfair, but to look, for example, at these great big mega churches, the startling thing to me is that when you go into them and sit through them, what you don't have is any sense of the enormous complexity of the history behind all these things. You have the feeling that Jesus walked in here yesterday, said a few things that the minister is correcting, and he'll pick up a few contemporary cultural phenomena like popular music and so on. You're seated in something like an auditorium. There's no cathedral atmosphere there. There is no great chanting choir and so on. And I think it's lost its that what I like to call its indefinability there.
Hmm. Are you religious yourself?
I am religious. You know, when I was teaching, students love to ask me, do you really believe in God? And I was embarrassed to say, and it seems like a kind of trick answer, but it's not, that they have to tell me first what kind of a God they think I should or should not believe in or could not. And there are many, many conceptions of God. That's one of the things I was teaching in those years, how differently God can be conceived. But if I were to, as you ask me, not whether I believe in God, but whether I'm religious.
That's my next question. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. All right. I would say yes, but in the sense that I, too, am endlessly fascinated with the unknowability, the unintelligibility of what it means to be human, to exist at all. Or as Martin Heidegger asked the famous question, why is there something rather than nothing? There's no answer to that. And yet, it hovers behind all of our other answers as an enduring question. And for me, it puts a kind of miraculous glow on the world, on my experience of the world and my associations with other people and so on. I would say in that sense, yeah, I'm religious.
James Carse is the author of the book The Religious Case Against Belief. He taught the history and literature of religion at New York University for 30 years. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Saltram Alione is one of the first American women to be ordained in the Tibetan tradition. She lived for years as a nun in the Himalayas, studying with Tibetan Buddhist teachers. Later, she left the monastic life, returned to America, and founded Tara Mandala, a retreat in Colorado, where she teaches students based on her training in Tibet, combined with the needs of the West. She told Anne Strangechamps about her latest book, Feeding Your Demons, and describes the practice.
The practice of feeding your demons comes from Machik Laptran, who was an 11th century Tibetan yogini. And she developed it after she was sent back by her teachers to reread the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is one of the main scriptural bases of Mahayana Buddhism. And within that, she discovered some passages about demons. And then that, combined with traditional shamanic practices in Tibet and Buddhist practice in Tibet, were her roots of this practice.
How did you first discover this practice?
I was living in a place called Manali, which is in the Kulu Valley, the foothills of the Himalayas. So when I first heard the Chöd practice, I was 25 years old. My teacher one day called me down to his room, and he was being visited by a Tibetan man who was ill. And this man requested the Chöd practice, which I didn't know at that time. And so then I came back that night, and as I came up the stairs, this dark hallway, because there was no electricity that night, the electricity would come and go, and walk down the hall to the shrine room, I heard this sound of drums beating and a rhythmic melody, and then bells ringing, and them singing in this ancient, beautiful way. And I went in and sat down and saw this man I'd met in the afternoon lying in the center of a circle, and then the monks and nuns sitting around him in the circle. And so in that moment, I first met the Chöd practice, although I didn't know what it was until the next day when I returned and asked my teacher, what was that last night? And he says, that was the Chöd. And I said, can I learn it? And he said, yes, and you can learn it from Gegen Kensei, who was the teacher of the monks and nuns in the monastery.
To feed one's demons, what do you do?
Well, I began to develop the practice of feeding your demons while teaching the traditional Chöd practice, which is quite involved. You use a drum and a bell and a thigh bone trumpet, and you sing in Tibetan and so on. And so in order to make this relevant and to connect it to the lives of the Western people that I was teaching, I began to develop this process of feeding your demons, in which you first find where you hold the demon in your body, meaning, let's use an example of something like a fear. When you think about that fear, you look at how you hold that in your body. In other words, when you feel that, where do you feel it most strongly in your body? And then, having found that location and feeling what it is in the sense of noticing, if it had a color, what would that be? If it had a texture, what would that be? If it had a temperature, what would that be? And so what I encourage people to do is, even if it is scary what you see, maybe it's a, well, let's go back to the example that I was using in terms of fear. So I've found it in my body, and it's red, and it's kind of pointy and sharp and hot. So now maybe I see that in front of me, and it's a skinny being. It's bigger than I am. It has pointed spikes all over its body. Its eyes are looking at me with a combination of aggression and fear. And so at that point, maybe I feel a little afraid of this being, this monstrous creature that I'm seeing in front of me. But then if you continue with the process, quite quickly it shifts. So even if it's scary right at that moment when it appears, it's generally not so scary that you can't go on with the process.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do then is you ask it three questions. What do you want? What do you need? And how will you feel if you get what you need?
You know, I was thinking that this process has a certain resemblance to some Western psychotherapeutic processes. Mm-hmm. However, the one thing that the twist, the thing that's so unusual, is the feeding of the demon. You don't just stop with, say, undoing the repression and taking a close look at this demon. Then you have to turn around and feed it. Why does that matter so much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is definitely connected to and related to various kinds of Western therapeutic methods where you work perhaps with something like a subpersonality or in Jungian psychology through active imagination, have a dialogue with a piece of the psyche or something like that. What's different about it is a couple of things. What you said, which is that you're feeding the demon, you're not only just meeting it and perhaps dialoguing with it, but you're feeding it. And not only are you feeding it, but you're dissolving your own body into a nectar of food. And you're feeding it to complete satisfaction. And so what happens is, because by turning your own body into nectar, there's a dissolution of the ego of self. And by feeding the demon to complete satiation, there's a dissolution of this energy that has been tied up in the demon. And there's a liberation of that energy. And so that is where it enters more into a Buddhist framework in terms of egolessness and entering a dimension in which we are free from both our own ego and the ego of phenomena or the outer world that we project.
Sultram Elyon is a Western Buddhist teacher and the author of Feeding Your Demons. She spoke with Anne Strange Champs. Coming up, a reporter goes looking for answers in the Old Testament. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. I've always been a proud Jew, but never a very observant one. That's the first line of Good Book by David Plotz. It's his memoir of his time spent reading every single word of the Old Testament to learn about his faith, to meet the God who'd broken his heart, and to discover what exactly is inside the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. By book's end, Plotz was no believer, but he found a way to love the Bible without making his peace with God. According to Plotz, the idea was born at a cousin's bat mitzvah.
I got started because I was bored at my cousin's bat mitzvah. And I don't know if you've ever been to a bat mitzvah, but some bat mitzvahs can linger on. And this was an incredibly long bat mitzvah. And so I just grabbed the Bible in the pew back in front of me and kind of flipped it open at random. And I came upon a story in the book of Genesis, the story of Dinah or Dinah, depending on your tradition, who's a daughter of Jacob, who goes out and is raped, and then the rapist wants to marry her. And Jacob's sons, who are Dinah's brothers, say, okay, well, you can marry our sister, but the condition is that you have to get circumcised before you can marry her. And so the rapist says, okay, I'll get circumcised. Not just you, you and all the men of your town. So he and all the men of his town get circumcised. And while they're incapacitated from the circumcision, Jacob's sons, Dinah's brothers, show up and murder them all and take their women and children as slaves and sack the town. And then when Jacob, their father kind of complains about this and says, hey, it's going to be hard to live in this neighborhood if you're going to be killing everybody. They say, what? Did you want our sister to be treated like a whore? And I read this story and I thought, you know, they didn't teach me this in Temple Sinai. And this is not hiding way back in the book of Zephaniah or Habakkuk or some part of the Bible no one ever reads. It's right in the middle of Genesis, the one book of the Bible everyone thinks they've read. I thought, if this is in the middle of Genesis, what else is there? And so I decided I was going to read the whole book, starting with in the beginning and going to the end.
So can you give us a kind of primer? Where do we start with the Old Testament once we've gotten past the begats?
Well, okay, so the primer is God, you know, picks out his people to lead them to greatness, and these people are the Jews, the Israelites, and they disappoint him. And then they try to get back in his favor, and they do briefly, and then they disappoint him again and again, and then ultimately are defeated militarily and politically and driven out of Israel into exile. And that's the basic story. God, you know, there's no easy way to say this. God is a horrible God. The God of the Jews is a very disturbing character. He calls himself loving and merciful and kind, and yet there's no act of, you know, kindness or mercifulness or very few acts of love in the book. And that the story, at least as it comes down to us, is of a jealous, angry God who is constantly disappointed because humans fail and we are frail. And then he commits acts of, you know, ruthless genocide against apparently innocent people who just happen not to be in our tribe. So I think that as a biography of God, the Hebrew Bible is really, really, really troubling.
Well, at the very least, the religious lesson is that we have that in our background and need to be aware of it. If you're looking for a morality tale, I suppose.
That's a fair reading. That's a very fair reading. And I think, well, for somebody like me who found myself more and more disturbed by God's acts of genocide or by the particular, you know, vessels that God chose and the acts that God committed, which are very troubling, there is a counter to it, which is that the most heroic characters in the Bible for me, and I would count Abraham as one of these, Moses at times, Job, a little-known prophet called Gideon, are characterized not by their obedience or their faith, but rather by their questioning of God and their doubt of God. And to me, the greatest moment in the Bible actually occurs almost right immediately after those begats. So you really should wish you'd gotten to it. But almost immediately after the begats, God drops by Abraham's tent and says, I'm on my way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, for their sin is so great. And Abraham says, but you know, the Lord of the universe, the creator of the universe, the dispenser of justice, how can you destroy these cities if there is even 500 innocent people living in there? And God says, okay, I can't do it. And Abraham says, well, what if there are 50 innocent people? And God says, okay, not if they're 50. And Abraham says, 45. And God says, okay, not if they're 45. And Abraham talks him down. God was preparing to sort of just smite thoughtlessly and universally. And Abraham is the voice speaking up and saying, you are doing wrong, God. And those moments are the clarifying and majestic moments in the Bible for me.
Is that why you think we should, more of us, read the Bible as part of school, for instance? Is it the same sort of thing as Shakespeare or Mark Twain?
It is. It is absolutely the same sort of thing. So I think several compelling reasons. The first compelling reason is that the Bible, more than any book, more than Shakespeare, I think you could claim even, more than the Constitution, defines the culture and language of our world. So you cannot know anything about how we speak and how we write and, you know, what our idea of story is without knowing its origins in the Bible. So again and again in the Bible, you come across a phrase, a word, a plot of a story, and you realize, oh my goodness, that's where this comes from. That's the source of you know, how I speak today. So I think just for purely cultural reference purposes, you need to know it. Then I think it is, when you think about what our laws are and how our society is structured, it is foundational. And to pretend or to educate our children and have them believe that, you know, the U.S. Constitution and ideas about, you know, what our laws are spring majestically forth in 1776 without any antecedents and without there being any religious element to it is to do a great injustice to our children, is to give them a false sense of where their culture and their government comes from. And then finally, even if you're somebody who is not a believer, or you don't care one way or another, there's a significant number of Americans who base their whole life and how they live on what they have read in the Bible, what they've been taught from the Bible.
Listening to you talk, it's hard to believe that at the end of this you didn't feel even more brokenhearted about God than you said you were at the beginning. But I get the feeling that's not true for you.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking today, and I haven't talked about the book for a couple of weeks, but in that period I've actually been writing the afterword for the paperback edition. And as I was writing the afterword, I realized that actually I was much more brokenhearted, or that what made me love the Bible and continue to love the Bible has nothing to do with God, that the God part of the Bible continues to disturb and repel and horrify me, and the human parts of the Bible do not. Insofar as we can say this is a work of man, which talks about our relationship to each other and the sort of fundamental questions about how we build societies, the Bible enthralls and thrills and delights me. Insofar as it is a story of a divine being who guides us and whom we look to for solace and leadership, it appalls me, and I can't be there with the God that's in there. So I think I've found a way to love the Bible without loving God anymore.
David Plotz is the editor of SlateMagazine.com and the author of Good Book. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 830A, Religion 2.0. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert and Madeline Mahon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strain Champs, Jug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can become a fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge on Facebook. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.